it's sort of particularly, you're particularly prone to make errors with this in Fortran because that Fortran, as we talked about yesterday, is fairly lax when it comes to checking types. So I could have something like this, where I would have two integers, let's call them k and l here, and then a real. And then maybe I set k here, I set that equal to 12, and then l, I set it equal to 14. And then I decide that I set x here equal to k over l. So does anybody want to guess what the value x will have at the end of the day here?
Zero.
Okay, yeah. So why do you say it's going to be zero?
Change.
Because they're integers and it's forced to the...
What?
It's forced to the greatest number less than or
yes.
equal to.
Yes. So what will happen here, and this is where this type checking and type conversions come into play, is that it'll look here and it'll say, oh, this is an integer, and this is an integer. And that means that this division here, it'll be interpreted as an integer division. And maybe that's a feature that you want. And maybe not. Maybe you were actually looking for the rational number that was 12 over 14. So if I had done something like this, where I had done k over 14.0, then the result would have been 12/14, right? Because what it's going to look at here is that this is a real, and then I'm dividing an integer by a real, and then it actually converts everything into real, and you return a real variable here. Whereas up here, then it's going to calculate first an integer, and that integer will be zero, and then we're going to implicitly convert that into a real. So here I get x equal to 0.0, and here I get x is equal to 12 over 14, which I'm too tired today to calculate in any numerical fraction. Okay, so this is actually something that you quite often exploit, that you can write programs where this occurs. In most other programming languages, when I reach this assignment, it would say, uh-oh, you're trying to assign an integer to a real. What do you mean by that? That's not allowed. But Fortran just lets you go ahead and do that. It can make for wonderfully weird errors because, of course, we are hardwired to think what we, that whatever we write is supposed to mean what we think it should mean. But that may not be the compiler's opinion about it. Okay, so are there any, just, yeah?
What if you write contact equals 1.0 times k over l? Does it give you a real number? Is that the right answer?
Well, it depends now. Then you're getting into tricky things about how things are evaluated, because it'll probably evaluate from this direction. And so it's going to try to evaluate the first fraction first and do that as an integer. So you can try to put parentheses around. And for instance, if you do something like this, then it'll come out and it'll be non-zero. But basically, I'm telling you that you shouldn't rely on triggeries like this. So you just have a look, and often if you're indexing in arrays and stuff like this, having the capability of doing integer division is really neat. I wanted to tell you one more thing here, and that's the fact that we've been talking about these functions, and I wanted to say that if we declare an explicit interface, either by doing it in the actual program or sticking the function in a module, so we could have some interface that would be for a subroutine here. And my subroutine again is called test. And I'm running out of sort of good names, but it has an argument which I call argument A. Then it has an argument which is argument B. And then the last one is argument C, right? So then we can perhaps do something where we tell everybody what our intention was with argument A. And that is that it should just be an integer, and the intent is in out here. So however, for the two last arguments, I can write so this would be argument B and argument C. I can put in another attribute. So I can tell the system here that these arguments are optional. And then I end my subroutine. And then I end my interface. So you can probably guess what the what's going to happen here, because this now means that I can actually call this subroutine with any number of arguments. So once you have the interface, then the compiler and the system will know everything that there is to know. So in your main program, which I look something like this, then I can do call test, and I can call it just on the integer 1, right? Because the two arguments here, I don't necessarily need to specify them. That means that probably inside the actual subroutine, we're going to have to figure out what will happen if those two arguments are not present. But that's for your implementation to look at. So I can then do something else here. I can call it just with the first and the third argument. And this is done by saying something like this. So if you don't want to, if you just want to exclude the second argument, this should be argument C here, right? So this word here, it has to match whatever you put here. And then, of course, I can also do a call test here of 1 and 2 here. And then I can do, of course, call test and maybe 1 and 10 and 13. But it gets even weirder than that, because I don't have to put the arguments in order, because, well, if all the information is here, then I can actually do things like argument C is equal to 13, and then argument B is equal to 10. So these two statements here, they would be identical. if you look at a lot of the Fortran functions, in particularly the intrinsic ones, then they have loads of optional arguments, so you can tune everything that you want to tune. Yeah.
So you always have to have the required argument in the first slot there. Like if you put argument C equals 13 first, would that?
I think you can. I think you can totally commute it. So you can. You should be able to write something like this, where it's argument C, which is equal to 13, and then argument A here, which is equal to 1. And I can call it with that. but this one always has to be present, right? Because you didn't declare it optional. So when you're writing your routine, and this is, of course, a subroutine, which is, kind of strange, then in the body of the routine, you need a little keyword here. So I can test for the presence of arguments B and C here. So I can do something like if present argument C, then I should do something. So I think for one of the tutorials, I'm asking you just to write a little function that would evaluate a potential. I think it's the Leonard Jones potential. And that potential, it has some parameters. And maybe you don't want to supply those parameters every time you call the function. So it's a good way of showing how you could write a function with optional arguments, where you would usually just call it with the function of x, which would be the position where you were to evaluate the potential. But then ever so often, you might actually change parameters in this potential. And then you can do that with playing around with the last two arguments. But if you do combine Fortran intrinsic functions that does stuff like this, and there's actually quite a few of them, that's what it means, right? It means that, oh, by the way, a whole slew of arguments to the intrinsic function that you're calling, you were never told about them. But actually, you can dig through manuals, and then you can see, oh, there was a number of optional arguments, and we can get to them typically in a way like this. OK? So enough with that. Then something that I guess I should have told you about before. Yes.
What does the present mean? It says if present, argument C, then.
Yeah, it's not something that you give for Christmas, right? it means that when that subroutine is called, it can test for the presence of the argument C. Right? And you will need that, right? Because the behavior of the function is probably going to be different depending on whether these two large arguments were there or not. And then, of course, you can do if not present, then you do something like that.
And that's just an exclamation mark?
Where's there an exclamation mark?
No, I mean for not.
Oh, well, I'm old fashioned, so I do dot, not, dot. I believe you can probably also do an exclamation mark. They sort of,
Can you do the same kind of thing with functions as well?
Obviously, yeah. There's hardly any distinction between function and subroutines. Basically, the only distinction there is that a function will return a value and a subroutine will not. Otherwise, they look entirely identical. And I don't know of anything that you can do with a subroutine that you can't do with a function. OK?
So how many of you have played around with MATLAB? Oh, well, it's a few at least. I'm sort of going backwards to very simple things. So I want to talk about arrays here. So we can write in our declaration, but and I think you probably already did this on a few occasions. I can tell the compiler that I want an integer. But it's not only going to be one. I also actually want 10 of them. And that I'm going to call my array A here. So that just gives me 10 elements that are integers. So that's one way of doing it. The other thing is, of course, I can do something even simpler. I can just do integer, then two colons, and then B of 10. So when we want to refer to elements in this array here, then we simply say A of 1 here is equal to 13. A of 2 is equal to 17 or whatnot. So Fortran, as opposed to C, the first element is always numbered 1 if you don't tell it otherwise. And the last element is, in this case, the 10th. Right. So please note that if you're coming from other programming languages. However, I can get clever here. So I can write something where I tell it that here you can see by default when I'm asking for 10 elements, the index that they'll have will be 1 through 10. But maybe I don't want that. Maybe I want something else. So I could write something where I'm asking for elements that go starting at 11 through 27, right? So the first element here, that would be C of 11, and then the last one would be C of 27. And the way that you're writing this, the range here that you want for the indices, you just have two a colon in between them. Or, of course, I can write something where it's called minus 2 up to 45. You can obviously see where this is coming from, because if you start working with tensors and so forth, then your indices, it just gets impossible if you have to mentally shift them back to always be between 0 and some positive number, which you would, well, to a certain extent, be forced to do in C. In Fortran, you can have any weird thing that you like, and it works wonderfully well here. So the first thing you then want to do, and we already talked about this, is that you're going to be sending the array to a subroutine. And we talked about the fact that this will likely be done by called by reference. So I could be writing a subroutine here. Well, I guess my subroutine today, since it's Wednesday, is not called sub, but it's called proc. But that shouldn't hold us apart.
So the argument is A here. And then you say to yourself, well, this perhaps becomes a little bit cumbersome because somehow I have to tell it how large this array is and what it'll do here. But maybe you don't. Maybe you want a subroutine here that will work and do something on an array that has any size. So you would have. You can write something like this, where you're just telling it that what is coming in is a 1D array, right? Then you will have to figure out then later perhaps what that size of that array is. And you can do that by using a function that is simply the size of A. So that'll tell you how many elements that are in there. This is a very typical way, if you're not doing something fancy with the array, then this is a very typical way of passing an array that would be any size to a subroutine. This here is called sort of assumed shape array here, because all we're telling it is that it's a one-dimensional array that's coming in. Another way that you'll see quite often here, and this is where it gets a little bit tricky, is I can write my subroutine, and you'll see that tons of time if you look in Fortran code here. So let's call this proc2 here. A, but then I tell the subroutine the size of the array that I have coming in. So then we would do integer here, and then I can just say A of n, and again, I want to point out that actually what is passed here is not the actual array here. It's a reference to the array, okay? But then maybe you want to do something with these elements here, and maybe you want to copy them into some other array. But when you're writing your function, you don't know really here what n is. So Fortran, or the newer versions of Fortran, they will allow you to write something like this. And this here is often called an automatic array. So the distinction here is that this here was an argument that came in, and I'm explicitly telling it what that array looks like, but this here is actually a local variable. It's going to end up on the stack that we talked about. Yes?
What about intent in or intent out commands for array? Can we?
Sure. You can do anything. I just left it out here. So you can, quite often, you would just do this without thinking. And basically, what I'm telling you here is that this will work. The other thing that I guess I forgot to mention, if you look over here, then you have other sort of strange arguments here that you can look at. I can look at not only the size of A here, but I can actually look at the lower bound on A here. But then I have to tell it, since A could be a multidimensional array, I have to tell it that I'm looking for the lower bound on the first dimension. So this here would be the first dimension. And or I could do the upper bound, A and 1. So if we had an array that was from minus 2 to 45, then the lower bound here, that would be minus 2, and the upper bound would be 45. So you have access to, yes?
So size would return then the product of all the lengths in multi-dimensional?
Yes, but I believe you can go in and you can use a optional argument, so you can tell it what dimension that you're looking at. So this brings us, also there's one little thing that is going to be, Fortran was built around using arrays, and basically anything that you would expect to work actually do work. There is one thing here that we have to think about here. If I write A33 here, something like this, integer colon colon A33, then we have to figure out so this would be an array where the first argument went from 1 through 3, and the second argument for 1 through 3. So actually, this here is a 3 by 3 matrix. OK. So the way it is stored here in memory is what is called column major. So it would be A 1 1, then followed by A 2 1, then followed by A 3 1, and then it would be A 1 2, A 2 2, and then A 3 2, and so forth, right? So the argument that's varying is the first argument and then the second argument. And that's sort of, if you think about the matrix, it would mean that you would store the first column first, then the second column and so forth, right? Anything in memory is, of course, stored in a linear fashion. So why am I telling you this? That's because C uses row major, and it's sort of a very unfortunate fact, because quite often you're actually going to perhaps look at a library that was written in Fortran, and you want to call it from a C program. Actually, the way that C or C++ uses matrices is a bit more fancy than in Fortran, but in C you can go back and look at the simplest way of writing a matrix, and it is largely identical to the Fortran way, except for its stored row major. And that's sort of a very painful experience the first time you come by this, because of course you can send the you can call the Fortran routine from C, but it just doesn't work, and it'll take you a while to figure out whether you need to then basically do the transpose of your matrix, right? So any kind of interdependence like this and large, nice echo, large programming projects, of course, you do this extensively. You know, you have things in whatever here. So this will look like this. So what else can we do here with these matrices? So that's the storage. And the only thing you really need to know about this is that when you're calling something that was not written in Fortran, then you're asking for trouble. And you need to have what they call wrappers around it and so forth. So we talked about if I have a higher dimensional array here, this is a two-dimensional, of course I can go to a 3, 4, 5 and so forth dimensional array. So I can perhaps write something like this, where I have A here, which is a 10 by 10 matrix. Then I have B here, which is also 10 by 10. And then I have a vector, which is also 10 elements in it, and then another vector, which is 10 elements in it. So you don't have to write gigantic do loops in Fortran anymore. So if I want to take this matrix and then apply it on that vector here, then I can actually just call an internal routine, which is called matmul here for matrix multiplication. It just takes the two arguments that are the two matrices that you want to multiply together. All these internal operations and matrices, it's highly optimized, so it works incredibly fast. The other thing is, of course, that maybe I want to set A here equal to A times B. And that, of course, also works because the multiplication operator here, it doesn't assume here that what are on either side need to be integers or reals. They've actually been clever enough to overload it. So it'll look and see, oh, this was a matrix, that was a matrix, and the dimensions, they match. And then it'll spit back another matrix. It just works, and it does it incredibly well. If you have seen MATLAB before, then they looked carefully at how MATLAB handles matrices and took the best parts of that. You were going to ask a question. Yes, I believe so. It's going to protest rather vehemently.
And also, can you take a matrix and put it to some power?
Well, obviously, you can do this.
Yeah, you could, right?
I don't know. Why don't you try?
Right.
So you can do.
If you really had to, yeah, you could just do.
I would be sort of 90% sure that this would work. I haven't tried. But it is one of the use arrays all over the place in Fortran. So they did a very good job of. Implementing this. The other thing here is that there are not only this here, I can, for instance, write something that if I have another real here, which is x, then I can write that x is equal to the dot product of C and D. By the way, I should say that this matrix multiplication is done with a fairly advanced algorithm, so it'll beat anything that you could possibly do on your own. I can do what I call array sections as well.
Using one dual pad or blocks or something?
No. This is actually hardwired in assembly. It uses what's called Strassen's algorithm, which will not be in Q, but into the 2.7.
It uses
solve this?
That's a numerical instance.
Well, you can have a. I believe that's true. Here, the what I was going to tell you about is that I can also write, for instance, that x here is equal to the sum of the elements. Maybe you want to sum something here. You perhaps want to sum the third row of your matrix A here. So this is what we would call an array section or something like this. So when it comes in and look at something like this, it says that the first argument of the matrix here is fixed, and the second one is free. So that means that this nominally two-dimensional array here has been scaled back to a one-dimensional one. Then I can sum the elements here. So I can use what I call array sections here, which is incredibly handy. Because I can, for instance, write that B here is equal to the seventh row. And this will work, right? Because what I have here is now a one-dimensional array of 10 elements, which I can equate to a one-dimensional array of 10 elements. This looks all fancy, but once you start using it, it's incredibly natural, and it'll work the way you want. So I can also say that maybe I want to equate row 3 through 7 with rows, actually the columns 2 through 6. In the other matrix. So by this we mean that I've picked out sort of a slice of this two-dimensional matrix, and as long as it makes sense here, then I can do this.
Can you transpose
here? Yes, there's a transpose algorithm here as well. I can even write something where I'm saying here that actually maybe I should set it the other way around. I'm not sure if this one will work. So I can set the these rows here equal to these rows. I can also write something where I stagger this. So I could, for instance, look at my linear array of 10 elements that I call D here, and then I could say that the first index here should go from 8 to 2, but I won't need all of them. I'm just going to take every third here. So this here will yield, the first one I'm going to get is D of 8. Then the next one I'm going to get is D of 5. And then the last one is D of 2 in that order. So if I'd done it the other way around, where it went from 2 to 8 in a, and this here is called a stride, then I would have gotten the same elements, but in the opposite order. If you do tensor work and want to pull out all this, then this becomes incredibly handy, because you can avoid all the do loops that you would have to put in by hand, which would just obscure what was really going on here. Of course, so I talked about the fact that I can multiply matrices. Of course, I can also
add them, right? So what else would I was I going to say here?
Is there any support for element-wise operations?
What do you mean by element-wise?
We take and perform a binary scalar operation on each respective element of the main interface. In what conditions an element-wise operation? But multiplication obviously is.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what you think about it. So.
Can you do A plus B?
Well,
so do like can you do A, B multiply every...
Yeah, like, can you do A and B, where it ands, or ors, or nans, each of the, each bit in every...
You can certainly, if you write this and you multiply your matrix with a scalar, that'll work. You can also take the, so I wasn't going to tell you about this, but you can take, for instance, the sine of a matrix, but it'll not do the matrix function. What it'll do is to take the sine of each element.
Right, element-wise.
Yeah, element-wise, which I don't like, because if I write sine of A, then I think of it determined as its power series, and it's something different. Particularly if you write x dot a, right, then it doesn't actually exponentiate the matrix, it exponentiates the elements individually. So if that's what you mean, then yes. The other thing here is that there's something that I call masks here. So I can write here where A is less than zero. I guess my matrices here, they just became real, so that's fine. So where these are less than zero, then, well, I set A equal to minus A. So it'll just, in whatever optimized way it has to do this, it'll look through your matrix, and then it'll figure out where elements are less than zero, and it'll set them positive. So I can continue this. So I can do something like this, where A here is not equal to zero. Then I can set A here equal to 1 over A. And then I can do something like elsewhere. I set A equal to 1. And then I end where. So there's a whole slew of functions that you can do to manipulate these matrices with. And basically pick out elements and shuffle them over to other parts of your program and do whatever you please with them. Okay, so back to the beginning here. I'm not going to tell you more about matrices if you or tensors or arrays. There's one thing I need to tell you is I can allocate them. So of course, if you needed to know the size of your matrices when you or your arrays at the beginning, then it would be a little bit cumbersome here. So you then would do something like this. You're saying that you're looking at a one-dimensional array, which we just denote here by two colons. And then I say that it's allocatable. And then I call it A. So that was perhaps your declaration part here. So this would be your program test here. And then in your main program, at some point, you call a function, and then you tell it to allocate that array with the appropriate. So for instance, here we could do allocate. And I take the name here, A. And then I tell it that I want now an array with indices that are running from 10 to 30. And so this is, of course, something that you could have determined from reading input from a file or calculated otherwise. And it doesn't have to be integer constants here. You can actually use variables in the program, and it'll allocate that matrix for you. Then when you're done here, then you're supposed to deallocate. And you just do that by deallocate A here. And roughly, of course, then some of you were asking about memory problems. So if I consistently call a subroutine that's always allocating an array but will never deallocate it, then we could be asking for trouble. So basically, if you do use one of these allocation statements here, then you should always combine them. Right? So you should match, right? If you have an allocate statement, then look further on, and you should have a deallocate statement. This is something that you'll end up using all the time. You'll read in an input parameter and then allocate space accordingly. And you couldn't do that a few years ago, yeah?
You can allocate a two-dimensional array.
Yes, right? Yes.
And could you allocate one dimension at a time? Like, let's say you wanted to go rows.
No, nope, I don't think so.
Okay.
Oh. You can. Yeah. Well, I guess I could see that in use.
Yeah.
Yes.
If we allocate A 10 to 30 here, and maybe can we allocate A 0 to 9 somewhere else or 1 to 9 somewhere else?
If
then will they be contiguous in memory? And can
This is going to protest. If you do this and then allocate it again later, if there's no intermediate deallocate, then it'll tell you, you'll actually get a runtime error, and it'll tell you that that array was already allocated. So that's not a problem.
So does deallocate erase the data? What exactly does it do?
It allows that part of memory to later be reused. Precisely how that is going to happen is not defined in any standard. You're relying on your computer system, and you shouldn't build a program that was relying on something particular happening there. Okay. So you'll likely do an allocate and a deallocate here, but what I was so end with arrays here. Let's finish that, and then I want to talk about something that is I haven't seen in maybe in newer versions of C++ or. Or C, you can do this. So I want to tell you about a kind and what that is. So why do we need this? Suppose I write real here, x, and then we haven't talked about this in much detail, but I could also say that I wanted a double precision, and that would be y. So in the Fortran standard, these two are keywords. And if you're building a compiler, they should understand them. But unfortunately, not so much in Fortran, but in particularly in the early implementations of C, you would have the same thing. You would have a float and a double. And the guys who wrote the compilers, they cheated. So they actually implemented them identically, which was sort of bad news, because you thought that you would be getting more precision here, but you didn't. The other thing is that you could actually ask yourself, well, is there something like a quadruple precision? And I don't think there is if you work on Proteus. But there is on my box at work. So it'll just bump up and give you more and more precision. And we'll talk about how these are implemented in detail. But anyway, the people who were designing programming languages, they got mad at this because the compiler vendors were cheating. So what they decided to implement is intrinsic functions here that allows you to basically ask for a given precision and then use that as your own particularly kind of real. So the way you would write it is that you would declare a parameter as we've done before. So we declare an integer here. And that integer here, I'm going to call it DBL, not to be confused with anything else in Fortran. This is just my own name for it. Oh, sorry, this should be a 2:: here. And then I set it equal to whatever is returned by an intrinsic function. And that intrinsic function is selected real kind. And that function, it takes, I need some more space here. This DBL here is equal to selected real kind, and it'll take two arguments, P and R here. So the first argument here, P is the minimal number of decimal digits. And the second one here, R, that's the minimal range of the exponents. So this here is the minimal range of exponent. Okay, so what will happen when this is compiled is that this intrinsic function here will be called, and it'll actually assign an integer, and that integer is called kind. So DBL here, it will contain the kind that corresponds to the precision that you have asked for. So maybe this sounds like all mumble jumble to you, but tomorrow you're going to be doing a tutorial, and you'll look at this, and I'll promise you that it's not going to be very complicated. So that means instead of doing double precision here, then I could go over, and after I have this statement, all I got back here was an integer parameter that we call DBL, and now I had to figure out how to use it. So I would have my integer parameter here, dbl. And then immediately following it, I can write something that you haven't seen before. I can forget about using real and double precision, which was defined in Fortran. I can use my own real and doubles, which are required to have the precision and the range here in the exponent that I asked for. So I can write here that I want a real, but not just any real. I want it to be of the kind that I asked for here. And then I'm going to call that I'm going to call that x. So this is a way that they figured out that compiler vendors couldn't get around, because you're asking for an implementation of a real. And of course, it could be any of these two, but you're requiring that the number of decimal digits is maybe 10, I don't know. And the exponent should be capable of giving you a range, which is what you asked for. And in that case, they're not allowed to then go back and implement a double precision here as a simpler real. So then some of you were asking about constants here. So I can then go down in the program, and then I say that x here is equal to 1.0. But I want to tell the system that the 1.0 is a constant, but it's a constant in of the real kind that I asked for. So I do this by putting an underscore dbl after it. And then so if you would test the system to see if quadruple precision is available, you would just go in and then you would ask for a real kind here, which would be have a range, which would be what you were looking for, and then you could see if the system would complain or not. So the other way we can write this is that I can say that x here is equal to real, where I take 1.0 and then I do a comma dbl, right? So again, you can see that this here is an optional argument to the intrinsic function real, which will take the first argument and convert it to something. But what it will convert it to is a real of the kind that we asked for. So what actually goes here is just some integer that will numerate the various different implementations of real that the compiler made available for you. Yeah?
Is it required that P and R be parameters, or can they be termed at runtime?
This has to go in your declaration statement. So I.
Well, but I mean, it, like if you had an argument function or something, you tell that function. Anyway.
Why don't you see if that will work or not. To be honest, I don't know. Possibly yes, possibly no. This is something that it is important that you understand, because if you do actual calculations, you want to control the precision of your errors. And this here, even though it sounds a little bit abstract, is actually very concrete and works wonderfully well. So are there any questions about what this means?
If you see multiply x by a regular real, does she always default to the precision as possible?
Well, again, you're relying on the fact that it will do implicit conversions.
So which side is it going to convert on?
Which? It's going to bump it up to the highest one. So if you multiply this here by a usual real, then it should work. Okay.
Well, that's what I was going to tell you about right now, but we should probably stop here, so I'll tell you about that tomorrow. So we have to look at how these are actually implemented. To answer your question, what you would typically be asking for is an 8-bit or 8-byte reel when you talk about double precision. But you could go in and ask for more. You could ask for 12 or so. The only thing I need to tell you is that there is also, of course, a selected int time. It only takes one argument here, it's R here. So what you're asking for is that it can represent from minus 10 to the power R here, and then up to R here, 10 to the power R. So if you ask for R equal to 2, it'll try to give you an integer that at least can represent values from minus 100 to 100. Some of you played around with the Fibonacci function, and you saw that if you asked for a Fibonacci number that was too high, then it came back and gave you minus something that was nonsensical. And that's probably because you exhausted the numbers that could be represented by the integers you were using. So you could have gone in and asked for a higher precision, and this is what you would have done here. So for the tutorial tomorrow, then you'll be playing around with these things, and basically it just works. And I'm out of here.